Kia ora and welcome to Better Off Red. My name's Pip, and this week I spoke with Wellington publisher and writer Claire Needham about The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. If you haven't read this book and have absolutely any inclination to read it, I would probably stop listening right now. This podcast is absolutely riddled with spoilers. Claire and I decided that it was impossible to talk about the book without spoiling everything, so it's spoilergeddon. If you have read the book, I imagine it has stayed with you in some way. In your memories, in your nightmares, perhaps when you go flying a kite. It was published in 1984. It's told from the first person perspective of the teenage Frank. The day after we talked, Claire texted me and said, "Oh my goodness, I just realised that Frank is called Frank, as in how frank is Frank being?" And she was extremely generous. She didn't reread the book. I asked her not to reread the book and she didn't. Neither of us reread the book. I'm extremely interested in what stays with us in books. I'm interested in what we add to books, what we imagine were in books that weren't in the first place, what we remember about books, what we don't remember about books. And so I really appreciate Claire not rereading the book, because it's a very awkward thing to do, to talk about something that you don't feel like you've just read. I think we had a great conversation. I enjoyed it a lot. We covered so much, sort of with The Wasp Factory as a starting point. You know, we covered character, gender, publishing, the publishing industry. We went there. We went all over the show. Horror. So I hope that you enjoy it, and thanks heaps for listening. Thank you.
Chapter 1, The Sacrifice Poles. I had been making the rounds of the sacrifice poles the day we heard my brother had escaped. I already knew something was going to happen. The factory told me. At the north end of the island, near the tumbled remains of the slip, where the handle of the rusty winch still creaks in the easterly wind, I had two poles on the far face of the last dune. One of the poles held a rat head with two dragonflies, the other a seagull and two mice. I was just sticking one of the mouse heads back on when the birds went up into the evening air, caw calling and screaming, wheeling over the path through the dunes where it went near their nests. I made sure the head was secure, then clambered to the top of the dune to watch with my binoculars.
We're going to talk about Ian Banks' The Wasp Factory tonight. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited about this because this is kind of the book that made me think about wanting to do this podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I read it, I think the last time I read it from front to end was probably possibly 24 or so years ago.
Wow.
Okay. It's a really long time ago. And I realised, I picked it up one day for something completely different. I think I was reading one of the science fiction books, I don't know, I went back to it. And I suddenly realised that the tone of it and the voice of it, I was borrowing in my own writing.
Okay.
Like, it had kind of sat for years inside of me, mm-hmm, in a way that I didn't fully acknowledge. Yeah. I couldn't remember a lot of the plot of the book, but something about the tone, the twist, the narrator, the character, the shape of it, there was something about it which had sat kind of inside of me, and was sort of leaking out.
Right.
So I'm really grateful that you haven't reread the book.
Yeah.
Because that really does, that's
it
a
was
scary thing, isn't
quite
it?
Quite hard not to, but I'm pretty good at following instructions most of the time. And I also thought it would be really interesting to see what it's like what you remember. Because for me, I would have read it probably 20 years ago for the last time, so we're in a similar sort of situation. And I think I only read it once.
Yeah.
But it was the first of his books that I read, and it made a real impression. But it is a long time ago, so yeah. I thought it'd be interesting just to see what's left.
Yeah, because when I was coming to talk to you today, and you know, like we've talked about this for about a month, I was thinking about what I do remember about it, and the things that I remember are the factory itself,
mm-hmm.
the poles, yeah. but not quite as well. I remember, and I have cheated and gone and looked at a plot summary, but
that's good, remember, so have I.
Oh, good. I can do that. I remembered that there was a big bad coming to town, like there yeah. was a stranger coming to town and there was a problem with that. Of course I remembered the twist and like this, if anyone hasn't read the book and wants to read the book, they should probably turn off right now.
Yeah, I think we need to do a spoiler alert because I think we do need to be able to talk about the twist. Do you
completely,
agree?
Completely.
Very good. I'm glad. It's quite important.
I'm just not sure. Even like our pronouns are going to be tricky.
Yeah.
But I just, those were the things that I remembered. But over and above that, what I remembered was being in the psychology of the narrator
yes.
and being on the island. Like yes. there was something about the geography and the landscape of the island. So what had stayed with you, do you think?
What had stayed with me was, I think I was saying to you earlier, a little prematurely, I had this impressionistic feeling about it. Partly it was a sense of isolation. I remember there was an island that was an isolated place that we were also inside the isolated head of a narrator and a first person narrator. I didn't check the book, but it is first person. And that you were seeing things through quite a filtered and contained lens and narrative. I remembered that there was horror, but I also remember being less horrified than I had expected to when people told me to read the book. And I remember feeling slightly disturbed by that. and that there were things that had happened that the narrator had described that I remember not being convinced actually had happened.
Mm.
We might talk more about that. Mm. So those memories. I definitely remembered the Wasp Factory and I remembered it as a visual. And so when I did go and do a little cheat and look at the plot notes, I was really glad that that visual really was what was in the book.
Yeah.
Because I thought I might have misremembered it.
Yeah.
It's quite specific. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think the cruelty in it is something that stayed as well. Like I remember, in a lot of ways, I think this was one of the first sort of unreliable narrator books I read.
Yeah.
Like I'd read Lolita as a child. Like when I was about 14, I'd read Lolita. Yeah, crazy. Don't know why. But so I'd read that when I was younger and I hadn't read it smartly enough. Like I just thought, everything he says is true.
I rely on him completely.
There you go, I rely on him completely.
He's trustworthy.
But there was something about this book that I thought, something's not quite right.
Well, you know there's something wrong with the narrator because morally there's something wrong with the narrator and you can't avoid that, even though because it's first person and the narrator is the person in whose head you are, and I always find in that case, I imagine I am them.
Yes, yeah.
You can't help but also sympathise with them.
Yeah.
So you're sort of on side of someone that you don't necessarily like or trust, but you are on side of them.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I was even thinking about that with Frank, because on the blurb of the back of this book as well, which I read, you know, there's the statement about, you know, I killed this person, I killed that person, you know, that child.
Yeah.
And I just remember that wonderful, because I think that's what stayed with me, was that moral ambiguity of, I did this, I'm not going to lie about it, I feel comfortable with it on this part of my psyche, but there's another part of my psyche that perhaps doesn't feel as comfortable with it or something.
Yeah, it's interesting because the deaths of the other children and the murders of the other children as reported by Frank, I'd completely forgotten those plot points. I knew that Frank did terrible things, but mostly I remembered the torturing of the wasps.
Yes,
And thinking about it now, I'm still... There's something about the flavour of the memory that makes me wonder whether you can rely on Frank to have told the truth about that.
Yes.
Or whether that's a grandiosity, you know, or whether really Frank did it. And a lot of it is true.
Yeah, because that's what I find, like, the one death that I remember really well is the kite death. Do you remember that? Like,
oh, now that you say kite.
Yeah, the small girl was given it. I think she's a girl.
Yeah.
Frank gives her a large kite. She takes off into the air and, you know, very thoughtfully, Frank has realised that as she starves to death, she'll get lighter and lighter and the kite will go higher and higher.
Yeah, and, which is a good way to cover your tracks.
Well, a very good way to cover your tracks. But it's really odd because sometimes I see them kite surfing at Lyell Bay and I can't and when Tallulah got interested in kites, I was just like, whoa.
Oh my God, but, do you know what can happen?
Yeah, do you know what can happen? Have you not read this book? But I think there's something, I think you're right. I think it's the cruelty to the wasps and there's some other animal cruelty, but for some odd reason that doesn't seem to play in the same way.
Yeah, and I sort of wondered, are we in Frank's fantasy life with the killings of the humans? And Frank's in a state where, you know, there's experimentation going on with torture and hurting animals, but it hasn't quite got to the point, maybe will, maybe won't, of actually acting out what's described as having happened, and I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. Like, I'm wondering, I was really interested in what you said, like, I can't remember for the life of me. I feel like this book was recommended and sort of, and for me, it sits in that same space as kind of the people that I hung out with that were slightly alternative or gothic.
Belonged to those people. These books and this author belonged to those people, and there was some sort of rite of passage to have them this shared with you. Was there something like that? That absolutely was my experience too. This was a book of the 90s for me. I know it's written in the 80s, but I didn't read it until the early 90s. It was recommended by a circle of friends I made at university at that time, and there was some sort of, it was like a, you know, there's a key to something secret and different that I was entering into, and this book was part of that. But I also remember thinking, you know, I've always been super scared and sensitive about horror films and things like that. So I wasn't sure why I was being recommended this book or why I was going to read it, because it was supposed to be so horrific. And then it didn't horrify me, and that disturbed me even more. Like, it really didn't. Yeah, I know. Now I'm confessing to being some sort of sociopath, but it really didn't. But I think it's because it's the first-person narrator and you're in Frank's head, and there's, you can't help but empathise somehow, or maybe not empathise, but just kind of connect.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I had a similar experience. I feel like I wasn't reading much at the time when this book came out, and I feel like this book was passed to me in the same way that a new album might be or something. And even, I mean, it's an old album, but it just, I'm just looking at the cover and it just so seems to sit in with Bauhaus and, you know, like, maybe, I don't know, like Fields of the Nephilim Ministry, you know, it just seems
a period of introduction to the new things in that genre. I had a different edition, actually, the one you've got here, which, although this is the Abacus edition, I had the one that had the black and white graphics on the cover, which I love.
Oh my god.
And there was a series of them, like that, I read Crow Road and a couple of others that had that that sort of graphic. And that's really part of the book too. When you asked me about the book and we were talking about meeting and, you know, talking about it, I immediately had the cover in my head. You know, a very strong memory.
Because that's, I think, this is what I find so interesting about it, is that it seems to have grabbed that, what I'm really interested in is that it doesn't, this might be my misremembering, but it doesn't seem to hold a lot politically or socially, if you know what I mean. Like, it doesn't seem to be like one of those sort of, you know, tomes that gets passed around sort of underground or anything. It feels like, you say, I think that idea of imagistically and emotionally like, it feels more like that kind of book, doesn't
it is that kind of book in terms of the memory for me. Like, I think it was playing around with sort of ideas of psychology, definitely. But most interestingly for me, you know, the idea of an unreliable narrator, because it was the first one I think I'd read as well. And I don't think I necessarily thought about it like that at the time, but I knew it. And I really like that kind of narrator, actually, too, the ones that aren't sort of hero protagonists. They're flawed. But yeah, I don't think of it as a political book or a sort of a social message book. And some of his other ones, certainly sci-fi ones, are more like that. But it's experimental in that way. It's creating a world and creating a sort of an idea and playing with it.
Did you read that quote from him where he said that he kind of had written some sci-fi books and they hadn't been published, and then he thought he'd wrote something more sort of realistic, and but he saw the island as a planet? Like, he was sort of saying that it was, it did feel like science fiction. And I was just thinking, you know, it's not the factory itself and the shamanistic kind of, it does feel like a culture. Yeah, like first contact with that kind of culture, right?
Yeah, it does. And it's like, or the sort of place that the culture from his sci-fi novels would go look at and, you know, go, oh, we should be intervening, but we won't, run away. But it is its own little cosmos. I'm kind of interested in, like, how many real people do you think are actually in this book?
I totally agree.
I only remembered two characters. I only remembered Frank and Frank's father.
Yeah.
And when I've gone back and sort of read the plot notes and things, my little cheat, I still am not 100% convinced that anybody else was real.
I totally agree. Like, I just feel like the phone calls from Eric, you know, there's no one else privy to those phone calls.
Yeah.
The father, I can't remember, but I remember there being something odd about the conversation. Well, I mean, the father is
beside the content of the conversation and what the father does.
Yeah, yeah, what the father does. But yeah, you know, like, there does, I totally agree. I feel like Eric could be a phantom, the policeman could be a phantom, the dwarf, you know.
Oh, like, the dwarf. It's like a great big, when I looked, I was like, oh, that's what the film was, a dwarf. I mean, really? I think maybe we are in the realms of the main character's mind in a lot of this, and that's a big clue. But maybe, you know, maybe not. Maybe it's just weird.
Because I think that when I read it very true. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I was like, I'm buying everything. I'm buying everything that Frank's telling me.
All these things are happening. All these things are real. Yeah. And that's why I was so interested, thinking back on it 20 years later, to go, oh, well, the only things, though, that have stuck in my mind are the things that possibly were the real. And I didn't even realise at the time that the others might not have been, but yeah.
Yeah, that's so true, eh? It's so true. I think we need to talk
About the twist and the tale.
I think we need to talk about Frank.
We need to talk about Frank. I think we've both done really well avoiding personal pronouns. We've been describing Frank.
We have done a very good job of describing Frank. I think this was one of the massive joys for me, and I think this is part of what I think I carried on into my own writing, was this complete ambiguity over Frank's gender, sex, whatever, you know, like. And no one had told me that was what was going to happen.
No, so good. Nobody did the spoiler. They gave you the book, but they didn't.
I just don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
But and I can't remember how close to the end it comes out.
It feels to me like really close, but I can't remember. Yeah. We may have to peek.
I just have no idea where it comes. But and it felt like the first time a book had I felt like it really was the first time a book had shifted me like that and just gone, fuck you.
Really? Yeah. You know, like, yeah. I'm just undone, or possibly not undone, everything that you know. You may have to go back and say it again, but you've got a different filter on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the story goes, Frank is a boy who has been castrated by a dog attack. Towards the end, he finds male hormones. Frank is actually a girl. Her father has been, well, you know, oh gosh, you know, that I mean, it's so great, isn't father. It I just really love how revisiting this in our current, you know, in the current knowledge of gender, you know, like, it's just so, I don't know, there's something so exciting about it, but there was just something so beautiful for me about the ambiguity of the sex and the gender. Like, it really excited me that someone could be, you know, that a character in a book could be both at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was something about, like you say, that revelation at the end where you just went, oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But also went, oh, you know, yeah, I don't know. Really? It was just,
Yeah, and then you kind of have this sense, well, Frank thinks of himself as himself a lot of the way through, but that, you know, because of being told that or whatever else, but at the end discovers something different. And I don't know that it doesn't change everything that's gone before, but obviously it's an implication it could change things going forward or not. But all the behaviours and all the thinking that you've been privy to is still the same regardless.
I just really loved it because I remember from a really early age feeling really angry at this idea that women think like this and men think like this. And like, what I loved about this book was that it gave me an opportunity to suddenly say, actually, you know, like, the psychology is not as vastly different as we want to make
it. And it's not unbelievable at all that that's the case. Like, I think, given that the character's so exceptional, like, in not necessarily a good way, you know, this sort of very violent, troubled, problematic character, that still doesn't feel wrong for whichever gender or combination of gender. You know, nothing sits wrong about it after you've had the revelation at the end.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing I was going to say, which I find really interesting, because I've been reading a few books from the 80s and 90s recently, and I was just thinking, there is a lot of serial killing going on in the 80s and the 90s, you know, like, it seems to be
that I wasn't aware
it
of.
Seems to be a slight preoccupation with a lot of books, like, even I was even reading Carl Shuker's Lazy Boys a little while ago, and that, you know, the central character is quite interested in serial killing. don't give anything away. You know, like, and, you know, of course he was American Psycho. And I was thinking that preoccupation with serial murder seems to have completely disappeared from our culture. Or is it just me? It seems to be more about the school shooter now.
Yeah, I think it's actually waned, because it wasn't just in literature and fiction. Certainly it was in television and movies as well. Yeah, I think you're right, it really has. It's sort of more, it's more mass violence now that's the focus, you know, regardless of whether that's more prevalent, less prevalent, or, but it was very, very much this kind of personal deviant violence was a preoccupation of the 90s, for whatever reason, I don't know.
Because, I don't know, it just hit me when I was looking at this again. Like, I was thinking, it's really odd, because that seemed to be, it was a quiet, it was someone that got away with it for years.
Yeah.
They were very clever, you know, generally hated their mother, you know, all that sort of
and
thing.
And that's where quite a lot of the unreliable narrators, sort of, those were the characters when it started, or when it started in terms of what I'd read.
Yeah.
They were those kind of, you know, social deviant, but perhaps normal seeming on the outside, and you're allowed into their heads because it's a book and you can go into the head of the narrator.
I don't know, I just found that really interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to do a weird segue now,
probably
the strangest segue either, which I haven't prepared you for at all. So I was just thinking, like, Ian Banks, as I said before, what I read tonight was that Banks had written several books which had all been rejected for publication. Then he wrote this book and it was accepted. And I was just thinking, you've worked in publishing.
Yes.
And you've worked in publishing in England.
Yes, I have.
And I'm just wondering what that was like. Like,
well, I worked for Penguin Books in England, but I didn't work directly in the sort of editorial or acquisition of manuscripts sort of part of the firm. I was one of the in-house lawyers. So I kind of got to see the process when that had already happened. I was kind of aware of how it worked because people explained it to me because I was interested, and it sounded like, probably not in all cases, but the big books, there was a kind of a bidding war basically for manuscripts. It was kind of very different to what I see publishing being like in New Zealand. And there was a lot of money involved. Not with all the authors, but with the, you know, the great big leading books. I was more involved in kind of doing things like libel reads and defamation checks and making sure that nobody was going to get into legal trouble because they'd said mean things about other people in the non-fiction kind of catalogue, which was really interesting. We had some really interesting authors. I had one author who had written a kind of a historical account of the IRA. So that was one we had to check really carefully, as you can imagine. And when he came in to meet me, he was so lovely. But he walked with a walking stick, and so immediately your mind is going, oh, I wonder what happened. So, and there was a really, it was an interesting time, and it was interesting to meet the authors and be part of this great, it was a great big organisation.
Because did you work in publishing? So did you go from New Zealand to that job?
Was no, I went from New Zealand to various kind of low-level crazy law jobs in London that you do when you first get there and you're just trying to pay your rent. And I think I'd worked probably for about a year in London beforehand doing these sort of part-time jobs. I actually went and worked for a business-to-business publisher for a while doing very sort of menial tasks as an expat because you could be got cheaply and dismissed quickly and that sort of thing. But that meant when I saw this job come up at Penguin and I applied, I had some publishing experience and that helped. And they were actually looking for someone on a six-month maternity cover, and so as a temporary person from New Zealand, that also appealed to them. But I ended up staying for 2 years. It was great, just fantastic people, within the legal team, and just really interesting editors. I kind of enjoyed a range of the editors, but the non-fiction editors and Hamish Hamilton, which was one of the presses, were the best. They were my favourites.
Would have been amazing. So were you writing before you took that job on?
I was, sort of for personal satisfaction, I guess. I was. I guess I've been writing for personal satisfaction since I was a kid.
And were you doing any of the theatre stuff that you do
No,
as well?
I did that when I got back
home. When you
home.
Got back.
Yeah, Sweet. So sort of when I was a lawyer when I went over there. That would be my sort of first career. I'd done 4 years here out of university and got that job, you know, with the legal strain, but I thought this, if I'm going to do law, this will be the kind of law I want to do, because it's book law.
Yeah, book law. Yeah.
Book law. And yeah, it was great. And then came back to New Zealand and ended up doing some writing courses up at Vic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then got work in theatre just to do something different again.
Yeah. Because
yeah.
I just, I'm always, I don't know, like, I it's that thing where, you know, I think when I met you, you were doing some writing courses.
Yeah.
Because I remember sort of thinking, ooh, a writer. Because I didn't know many writers at the time. I was like, oh, a writer. And then I found out you were doing all that cool theatre stuff.
Mm.
And, I mean, and now you're publishing again.
Yeah.
And not just a lawyer. I'm a lawyer
by
huge.
Day. You know,
you're so like Superman.
I'm like Superman. I was going to say Batman, but I'll go with Superman. Yeah. Lawyer by day and publisher by night, amongst other
yeah.
things. And still, you know, scratching away at the writing, but in a, yeah. Still a personal capacity.
Yeah. I think it's really great to get that balance, hey?
Yeah.
How do you strike that balance? What's your secret?
Well, actually, it's, you know, all brand.
No. All brand. Yay, all brand!
That's the secret to balancing it all. I don't know, trial and error.
Yeah.
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 And making sure you actually do get enough sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Sleep is good.
Sleep and all brand.
I always thought, you know, it was about not getting sleep, but yeah.
Yeah, I think your 20s are.
Your first book was on your press.
Yes.
Very exciting.
Yes, very exciting. Exciting, Giant Sparrow Press. Yes,
it's wonderful. That was last year, right?
That's
or the
right.
year before, last year.
Last year. It's a collection of short stories by Julie Hill, who's an Auckland-based author, and it's called Shame Joy.
Yeah.
Nice, dark stories, yeah, I'd say. You know, not exactly the same genre as The Wasp Factory, but they've got a darkness to them, but also lots of humour.
They're so good.
They are,
it's
they?
One of my favourite books of last year. I just loved it so much. And I just think... beautifully published as well.
Thank
like,
you.
Because you edited them as well, eh?
Yes, I did. I think that's sort of where I enjoy myself most as a publisher is in editing and actually sort of getting to grips with the manuscript. And Julie was great to work with in editing. She's a professional writer as well. She's a journalist. And she understands feedback and she's really painstaking about getting the manuscript right. But editing I love.
Yeah.
Playing with the words.
I just super love, I just did an interview with Lawrence Patchett and John Summers, because I'm quite obsessed with this relationship. I always find this relationship really interesting, like where it sort of becomes quite collaborative, eh?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and it's that cool thing where editors and publishers, I saw, Fergus said something on Twitter today about that job where you're kind of invisible, but also, you know what I mean?
Like, but you're also very much part of it.
It seems like the perfect job for me. I wish I'd known about it
when you became a writer.
But I just really love this idea that you can, and I must say that, you know, I've been really lucky because Emma Barnes has let me sort of come along for the ride with Cats and Spaghetti.
Cats and Spaghetti,
and I know that when, you know, when Sugar Magnolias, that night, I've never felt better about anything. You know, you know, I know that sounds awful, but...
Pride.
There's something
Not bad
wonderful.
Pride, good pride.
Yeah,
the warm pride you feel for your children. You know?
Yeah, and it's just such a wonderful thing. And I do feel so nice in that slightly more invisible... I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm probably humble-bragging. But, you know, like, I just love the idea that you can say... we love this work and here's the person that created this work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then see it fly. And some people are better at being the person who created the work and being, you know, the person on show and you know, that I'm not that comfortable with that personally, actually. I mean, I'm sure I could, you know, I can if I have to. I have to do it in my day job.
Yeah.
But I always feel like I'm kind of faking it. But I do. I love the meat of producing the work. And I think writing benefits so much from editing. It's a really positive relationship and well-edited work is better for it.
And it's just that wonderful thing of kind of like that first audience, you know what I mean? And the first audience is like, and I remember Brent saying something once, like I had something back from an editor and I was like, oh no, and I felt really sad and stupid, and you know, but what he said to me is, it's real tough because this is one of the smartest readers in New Zealand, and, you know, she's your first reader, and it was just like, I guess, but there's just something wonderful about that first reader, and then, you know, like you just start, and then you both start making this noise together. Like, the work starts happening in between the two of you rather than it happening in my head or something.
Do you feel yeah, do you, it sounds like you do actually feel that it's a help, and it's because it's meant that way, but it's sometimes you want to deliver it in a way that doesn't cut the person down or back, it's got to be positive, it's got to be like growing the work, and yeah.
Oh, I love that idea of growing the work. Yeah. That's so cool. And I mean, it's one of the hardest, because I mean, I don't know, like I work by myself.
Yeah.
And then I must be dreadfully prickly for someone to come and say, hey, you know, da da da. But
it's natural to be, though. Like, I think the good thing as well is that if you also write or have written and receive feedback, that helps. And most editors, I'd say, in New Zealand have or do, and they certainly know about what that whole dynamic is like. And that's one of the good things about doing the courses I was doing when we first met.
Yeah.
You know, as you'd know, there's heaps of feedback coming from your classmates, and it hurts to receive it, but after a while it hurts less, and it's good practice.
Yeah.
Totally, but then you know if you're giving feedback what it feels like.
Yeah.
So
you're not like, this is dreadful.
Yeah, it's shocking. I've redlined it for you.
Yeah, I've redlined it. I remember my first essay coming back from university was like that. My teacher had just put a big red cross and written no.
Not very constructive.
Oh, he was pretty cool. I really liked him. He was groovy.
He was open to a conversation after
very,
that.
He was very open. Well, no, he was just fantastic. I was just like, yeah, this is hardcore. This is really hardcore. Oh my God, so that's exciting. So are you working on anything publishy at the moment?
Yes, I am working with another author. And we're working on a manuscript at the moment that's going through a sort of rewrite editing process, actually, my favourite bit. Yeah, so that's all good and kind of exciting. I'm letting it take the time it needs to take. I think it's taking longer than I thought, but I also think it's taking the time it needs. Yeah, sometimes
This is a really interesting, I don't know, like, sorry, I know we're getting miles from the
watch. That's all right.
We'll come back to you. Don't worry, Ian, we're coming back. But I'm really interested in this idea of having worked in, you know, somewhere like Penguin, where I imagine there was deadline, and whereas now, you know, you're kind of the boss, you know, well, not the boss, that's a dumb word, but, you know, like, you're in control.
I think of it more as kind of DIY.
Yeah, DIY. And I just, I mean, what, I don't know, like, I'm really interested because there seems to be a lot more independent publishing kind of popping up all over the place.
I think what's interesting about it is, depending on how you do it and the patience of your author, then you can do it in a way that fits with who you are and how you are, because it is kind of your gig and your author's gig. And I wouldn't do it otherwise, because it is, you know, it's an extra thing on top of day-to-day life, but it's a thing that I'm passionate about. And, yeah, for me it's about the enjoyment of the process as much as anything else, and rushing it wouldn't be enjoyable. But I also think rushing it with editing isn't a good idea. I mean, I understand you have to in a commercial publisher, and you've got to do the best you can, because there are deadlines and there's budgets and, you know, all those things exist independently, but you can play around with it a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like the flexibility of taking the time you need to if you want to, and
Do you, so I don't know, this is, everywhere I go, everyone seems to be, do you feel positive about publishing at the moment?
Do
you feel
positive about it? I feel a bit mad, crazy, because I do. But yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do, because I guess the way I'm participating in it is kind of pleasurable and very, you know, about well, it's not exactly about me, but it's about doing something I want to do how I want to do it. So I'm really lucky. I can understand why people would be feeling negative about it, because, you know, you see lots of bookshops closing down and you don't know quite what's going to happen with books, although I don't think they'll never, you know, I think there'll always be books because people love books. I don't know. I feel positive about it personally.
Yeah, because I feel really positive too. And I totally understand. Like, I feel like there is a shift happening. Like, I feel like it's possibly not, well, it doesn't look the same as it did. Like, when you think about when this book came out in the 80s, like, I mean, it doesn't look anything like that anymore.
No. Well, ebooks are a great big real part of the market now. That's one thing I do remember at Penguin, that there was an ebooks guy, and it was one of the youngest editors who'd sort of put his hand up to do it. And nobody really seemed to understand what it was, take it seriously, take him seriously. But he, you know, he's probably all over it now and doing very well through it, which is good. But it was this kind of, I don't think anybody really believed in them. It was like, oh yes, ebooks, they're not really going to happen. So that's big and different now.
I've been reading, I've just finished, just been reading The Martian. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's this crazy good book. And it was a book published by the guy, his last name's Haig, maybe. I'm going to totally misrepresent him. I'll put a link on the page. He published it himself, popped it up on Amazon, you know, and now it's, you know, very big bestseller. Everywhere I was up at a sort of TET conference in February, and every single person was talking about it. It's such a marvelous book. It's a really good book. But it's just that thing where you think, there's no way anyone would have published. Well, I don't know. Like, it feels like a book that wouldn't have got published. It's extremely science heavy. There's pretty much no story. The the writing is clunky.
Yeah.
But it is just absolutely compelling. You know, because it's a human who gets stuck on Mars and has to, you know, like, feed himself for so many days.
Survive.
It's like a Robinson Crusoe, but in Mars.
Yeah, but in Mars.
But in Mars.
With real science.
With real science, yeah. And it's just, I don't know, like, I do feel quite positive. And then I think, oh, but then in my darker hours, I think, oh, no, oh, it'll be bad.
I guess it's because it's sort of, there's a process of transition going on.
Yeah.
And transition, I got this philosophy, transition is hard.
Yes.
In any experience in my life, transition has been hard. Yeah. It's difficult in birth, it's difficult in the bigger picture. And so when things are changing and transitioning and it's uncertain and old things are falling away, there's damage to that and new things are coming. So it's not an easy time.
No, I totally agree.
I guess I probably got an overall hopeful approach to life. I've chosen to adopt a hopeful approach to life, so I apply that to publishing and books and stories.
Maybe I'm the same.
Yeah, and then you see the good things, like what you've described, people being able to access an audience directly that just might not have happened before. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. So back to Ian.
Yes.
Mr. Banks. Sorry, I was sadly no more with us. Oh, that was so sad. I'm embarrassed because I've only ever read Considering Phlebas. I haven't read the Culture novels.
That's okay. I have read some of them, not so many of the more recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like all the books I read back in the 90s, I don't really remember them, but I sort of vaguely remember the culture as a concept, and I do remember enjoying some of them.
Yeah.
I particularly remember this, so the culture is this sort of anarchist space. Not aliens, because some of them are humanoids, but it's a different civilization to ours. And they, among other things, kind of encounter other cultures or other civilizations and choose whether or not they're going to, how they're going to interact with them.
Mm.
But their main approach is to try not to influence generally,
even
when they see things that kind of horrify them, because they're, and the description is that like a post-materialistic culture, they don't need material things. Well, they've got all the material things they could possibly wish for, so they don't have to worry about that. They don't have money. And so they don't necessarily understand culturally the things that they're encountering, but they also don't want to do any harm, mostly.
Yeah
Really interesting idea.
It's huge, eh? And like that sort of I remember that being another thing that really appealed to me about him, was the branding of the science fiction and the, you know, the Ian Banks books and the Ian M. Banks books. I was really interested in that idea, and I was just thinking, when I was reading, when you read that first bit tonight, though, I was just thinking about how it made me think of Margot Lanigan, and I was just thinking about how in a lot of her collections, stories like the Ian M. Banks ones and the Ian Bank ones could just sit next to each other.
Yeah.
Because we have that zone of, like, speculative fiction now.
Yeah, which I'd love the word speculative, or the phrase speculative fiction. Something about it that excites me, I think probably because I like the genres that fall within it.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that it kind of opens up those links between things that are sort of sci-fi and fantasy and gothic and maybe more mainstream, not labelled with a genre, but speculative. Yeah, I really like that. I like Ian M. Banks, and you'll know I'm always banging on about Ursula Le Guin, who's my favourite author, and she's Ursula Le Guin and Ursula K. Le Guin.
Yes,
for her science fiction.
Yes.
I like to think Ian stole that from her.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah, in an emulatory sort of a way.
Yeah, and I just think, it just made me think about maybe that shift, you know, like that, you know, there was, because I just remember his books looking so different. And for years, as a dopey person that wasn't talking to anyone, I honestly thought they were different people. I thought, oh, that's odd.
Because of the design?
Because of the design. Yeah. And I mean, I'm stupid because I realise now that the typography of his name was often the same.
Like, yeah,
it's often the same.
Across different editions.
Yes. And, but it just, I don't know, like, I just was suddenly thinking, you know, interesting moment in literary history where we sort of had to say, whereas, like I say, like I've sort of read across them.
Yeah.
Like I wonder if there are any people that only read Ian Banks.
Or only read Ian Banks.
Yeah.
I wonder. We need some readers to
Maybe some of them will
comment. But yeah, I wonder, because I know some people are very strongly just no to science fiction.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and I accept that because it's probably genres that I don't spend a lot of time in, I would say.
Yeah.
I love science fiction, so I'm kind of biased.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. Like, I was introduced to science fiction by my friend Jen Martin. I think the first book, well, she gave me Ridley Walker, which I guess you can't really, it's a tricky one. But I mean, the passion with which she talked about science fiction just made me start reading it. And like, I always said, oh, I don't tend to read the space opera, but I do. You know, like, I just, I'm awful like that. And, you know, I just think it's really interesting what happens when you read Consider Phlebas, and then come back to him in something like Crow Road, or is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah, Crow Road, or one of those ones. Like, there's a really weird
There's definitely crossover. There was another one that I was thinking about, and I've forgotten what the name of it is. It's really great, but it's one where there's a brother and a sister.
We've got
an aid memoir. This is very helpful. I'm just going to check because I will probably find it. A Song of Stone. Yeah, there's a brother and a sister, and it's sort of, it's a timeless, possibly medieval, possibly not time, and they're in this big castle, and there's an attacking force coming, and that's one of Ian Banks' books.
Yeah.
But it feels, it's definitely into fantasy slash, you know, it's definitely speculative. I remember that having a very strong impressionistic effect on me as well.
Fuck, he's incredible, eh?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's something like, just when you were looking through that thing, what's that thing called? An aid memoir.
Oh, you know, thing to jog your memory.
This is very good. I know things now.
I'm not sure if I'm using that right. Actually, no, it's usually like a note, but anyway,
I think it's perfect. But yeah, I was just thinking, like, when you look down there, like, I was thinking that today. I was writing something, and I was thinking everything I fucking write sounds the same. You know, like it sounds really the same. And then you know, like, but when I read him, I just think, holy shit! Like, there's a sense of him and his touch.
Yes,
but. You know, like you say, where we can go from timeless, possibly medieval, to, you know, deserted, very contemporary. Mm. Like, this book's definitely set in 1984, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is, and it's very British. Like, it feels very much like a British book. And possibly, you know, I don't know Scotland, and it's kind of feel well enough to know if it's very Scottish, but I imagine it is.
Yeah.
Or you can end up in the mind of a spaceship.
Yes, exactly. Crow Road's got the pop music...
The band.
Yeah, like, so there's this, I don't know, like, I just feel like this is one of those huge minds of literature, you know, and that, it's interesting you say that Scottish thing, because I really like Scottish literature, and it wasn't, he never sits in my brain as a Scottish writer, and I don't know why.
That's interesting.
He just never sits there.
Does he have, does he have something like that? Does he have a nationality in your mind, or is he...
No, he just sits as this kind of... big brain that can experience everything.
Like one of his ships.
And I was just thinking about like the end of Consider Phlebas, where you've been in this huge war and then it just lifts out and you realise it's happening in one tiny part of the universe.
Yeah, you know? And you're allowed to see that perspective.
Yes.
And because he can see that perspective.
Yeah, and that's what I feel like his imagination is like, is that all of these things are just tiny little parts of this huge cosmos that he, you know, has understood and explored and everything. It's just so wonderful. My goodness. Do you think you'll read it again?
I'm actually quite tempted to.
Me too.
I'm really wondering, if I do, whether I will be horrified this time. Like, whether being 20 years older and a different version of myself, I will actually be horrified.
Yeah.
I sort of hope I will. I do find it disturbing that I wasn't the first time.
Because it is really interesting, like, that idea of horror, because I'm tricky with this book as well, because I'm pretty sure someone around me was reading American Psycho at exactly the same time. And I was dipping in and out of, I didn't have enough guts to read the actual book.
I was going
to
ask if you actually read American Psycho, because I haven't read the whole of it. I couldn't get all the way through. I found it too disturbing.
It's really disturbing.
See, I'm not as sick as I thought I was. I couldn't read American Psycho.
You're fine. You'll be fine. Okay. But, but I was thinking in here that I do remember, the horror is, it's really odd how there are different shades of horror, aren't there? Like, this isn't the, what do the kids call it? Is it called a jump? Just whole, like, Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah, they have jump scares. That's right, it's jump scares.
Oh, a jump scare. Okay, so something leaps out and frightens you. Like in a movie when you know the music's indicating something's about to jump scare. Yeah, okay, this is not jump scare. No, this is like slow burn. Yeah, it's more like you're... you're horrified inside, but yes. you can be very quiet and still while you're feeling horrified. Yes.
And I think it's also the thing that I remember about it as well is that it won't let you look away. You know, yeah. that thing, like, you know how you're like, you know, I'm just thinking like Alfred Hitchcock had that big thing where, oh, if you can't see it, you'll imagine something worse.
Yeah. Whereas this, which I think is true.
Which I think is probably true. Maybe that's why you weren't horrified by this book.
Actually, maybe it is. Maybe I am somebody who's much more suggestible. And so at least I was shown
yes.
as much, you know, as he took me as far as he was going to take me and he didn't make me go any further, which yeah. is kind of him.
Yeah. Which is a really interesting. It's like, I was talking to, it was actually at the prison, and prisoners read. That's a gross generalization. Mm. Some of the women that I'm working with at the moment read a lot of what they call true life stories.
Okay.
And they were talking about how they really like the first person narration mm-hmm. because they feel like they're being led through, and they yeah. know that they know that the narrator's not going to die
because they're telling them.
Yeah, because they're telling them the yeah. story. And I was thinking that might be part of what yes, this is about as well.
It might be. It might be. There's some sort of comfort of being in the narrator's head. It's that whole first person thing. Even when the narrator's head is a horrible place. Well, I didn't find that with American Psycho. Yeah, I just didn't like the narrator's head with American
yeah,
Psycho.
Yeah, I think... But... And American Psycho is way past this.
Yeah, it is.
It's got
That's
to
the thing, that this is more suggest... Yeah, I don't know. It's not... It's graphically horrifying.
Yeah, yeah. And you see, that's the other thing I was thinking about with this as well, that just reminded me, a lot of the people that were talking about it at the time, I'm sure, were sort of in that little part of my world that was animal activism, you know what I mean? Which is quite interesting because...
Oh, yeah, like, horrified by the wasp factory.
I mean, most of the horror does come down on animals.
Yeah.
But I think that was part of... I think, you know, even though I say it's not a political book, I think that was a lot of the politics, was that idea that... You know, we were treating animals cruelly, but in ritualized cruelty, right. you know, maybe people can see it more clearly or something like that.
Or it sort of stands for something
yeah, it's
different.
Really, it is horrifying, though. And it's not, that is a genre I don't read. I tend
horror,
not
no,
to read
I.
horror. Like, I've never read Stephen King. Have you read Stephen King?
Not any of his horror.
No.
No, I
you
think
see,
I've read maybe because he does write sort of more,
yeah.
I don't know if you describe it as sci-fi or fantasy, but
yeah.
I've read a little bit of that.
Yeah. And I tried to read Wake by Elizabeth Knox, but got too frightened, so I didn't get very far through that. I had to get Brent to read it and tell me what happened, which is embarrassing. But, you know, it is, I think, I would be really interested if I could handle it now.
Yeah. I remember reading horror as a teenager. I'm reading, like, the Silence of the Lambs series, because there's a series of books, and being really frightened. But still reading them all, like, keeping going, which doesn't feel like me at all now.
Yeah.
I'd be too scared.
And I do. I am really interested in this idea of being scared because I just, you know, like I say, with Tallulah at the moment, she's watching a lot of walkthroughs of really scary video games and stuff like that. And that's part of, and even as a kid, you know, like some of the fairy tales are so dark.
Yeah, fairy tales are super dumb. Fairy tales are horrifying. I think that's part of that genre. It's a deliberate part of that genre. You know it's real because it's horrifying because it was about life, which can be horrifying.
Yeah.
I like that in fairy tale, though.
Yeah, me too. I really... I've got
There's no punch pulling going
I've
on.
I've got the Angela Carter fairy tales, which I absolutely love. They're some of my favourite books. But I think also, you know, that thing of... yeah, just that idea of the Silence of the Lambs and that sort of thing is, I used to look after these teenagers when I was in my 20s, and it was really interesting because they sort of had that burgeoning sexuality, and there seemed to be some tie-in between those books in particular, you know, like, there seemed to be some tie-in between sort of body violence.
Yeah, slasher horror and teenage sexuality or sexuality. I think there definitely is. This is making me think of watching, it's not Five Nights at Freddy's, but it's Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Which is all that. It's, you know, nubile young teenage bodies and lots of gore and slashing.
Yeah.
And it was, there were, I think, sexual elements to that film.
Yeah.
As well as it being horrifying.
I'm sure there was. And I remember, because I remember it being that it was almost... I don't know. This is my theory on it, which will probably, I don't know, might get me arrested. But I always think that it's this moral thing where sex always needs to be dangerous if you're a teenager. Right. Therefore, we can show you sex in horror.
Yeah. So that you're frightened. So that you get the message. These two things go together. Yeah. Shouldn't do it.
Yeah, shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if, you know, there's something about that. But I am...
I think you're right. There's definitely... There were horrors and horror books and films which were sort of where sexual activity... You get punished for it, basically. You're going to be the victim of the slasher because you've just been having sex. Like, the start of Jaws, the shark.
Yeah.
The woman who's just been having sex.
There you go.
So there's something... Whether that was intentionally moralistic or just about, you know...
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's... I mean, that is one of the things that I do love about horror is that it comes... It becomes a very... It is a very body sort of genre, isn't it? Like, I mean, and even, you know, like that the twist in the tale of Wasp Factory
is about the body.
Yeah. And I'm just always interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah. Also, your body is like your mortality, isn't it? It's the bit of you that if you think something can be immortal, you don't think it's going to be your body. That's fair. So death and the body do sort of go quite closely together.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's deep.
Yeah, man, we were profound.
We are profound.
I'm proud of us.
I think we, I don't know, have you got, is there anything else that you wanted to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
No, I actually think we've got all the thoughts I had out of remembering this book.
Yeah.
And there was a lot. There was more than I expected there to be, which was cool because I do remember it being a really important book and it set me off reading lots of his others.
Yeah. It's a fantastic thing to think, like this is a reason that I wanted to start talking to people about these things, because it does feel that this book's been with me for 20 years. There have been, you know, there's been like long periods where I haven't thought about it at all. But it's just, it really does feel like it's
still ingrained
in
you. Yeah, actually that was the other thing I was going to say, because reading your book over summer, your novel over summer, when I was thinking about this and feeling the impressions in my memory, which was sketchy because it's so long ago, there was something common going on
for me,
having really freshly read your book. Perhaps partly because you've got this narrator who's sympathetic but not always sympathetic.
Yeah.
But it's probably more than that now that you've explained that kind of inside you as you're writing.
See, the other thing I realised was I watched My Own Private Idaho about a year ago, and there's a scene in that where Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix are around a bonfire and they're both having sex for money, and Keanu Reeves kind of says, I'm having sex for money because it's good money, and River Phoenix, you realize, is having sex for money because he likes having sex with men and he likes Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
And like, I've realized that that's the plot of almost every short story I've ever written. You know, the idea, you know, like, it was just
so you've
sudden,
got My Own Private Idol, or a scene from My Own Private Idol.
And that's why I always think it's weird. I never feel like I write a book by myself. Like, I don't think you can ever say...
I don't think people... You can't write it in some sort of vacuum where the things you've consumed story-wise and literature-wise and stuff is not there. You can't. Because they do. They stick to us. They stay with us.
They do. And that's what made me interested about this. Because like I say, you know, I'm sure that I'm sure there have been moments where I've said, oh, yeah, I think I read that. You know, like, I've sworn there's been moments where I just... You know, but I don't know, it's such a wonderful book. I do want to read it again now.
This is one I don't doubt I've read. Yeah, absolutely. I've got no question marks about that. And I have heard, my mum is a voracious reader. She reads so many books. And she does get books that she starts reading and she'll get quite a few chapters in and think, oh, I have read it before.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I have done that not as often because I don't read as much. Yeah. But this is not one where I had to go, oh, I don't know if I've read that. I don't know if I can talk to you about that one.
Are you a fast reader or a slow reader?
Fast.
Are you? Mm. Oh, man. I wish I was fast. Faster. It takes me forever to read.
It's good and bad, and sometimes it means you need to read it twice. You probably spend the same amount of time with it.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, because you sort of, well, definitely I get more in a second reading often because I've gone too fast to find out what happened.
Oh, yeah, I love a plot. Mm. And that's the other thing that I realise with this is that there is, you know, there's that driving thing of Eric arriving.
Yes.
Which I think is so interesting because we've remembered it as imagistic, but really. Yeah.
It's like, actually what gives the book its momentum, doesn't it? And its plot drive. I mean, you're interested in Frank. You're very interested in Frank and what's Frank doing? What's going to happen next? Why is this all happening? But actually a real driver is this menace, this oncoming menace.
And Eric is not happy.
And how can this menace be such a menace to someone who is already such a menace?
Yeah. Oh, my God. And
must be really bad.
And that whole ambiguity, what I remember as well is that Frank didn't know whether to be excited or upset. You know, and I just loved that.
Yeah.
Like, that... You know, this was the conditioning you know, this was the nurture that had, you know, like, it was like, am I happy that Eric's coming?
Am I really frightened, or am I?
Is it going to be great to see Eric, or is it going to be bad to see Eric? You know, yeah, it's just fantastic. Yay, Eric. Have they ever made a movie out of this book?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you think it would make a good movie?
I think it would be hard to do.
It would be really hard to do, but it could be really good.
Yeah, it could be really good, actually.
Atmospheric.
The key would be to get inside Frank's head.
It'd be hard. It'd be hard. Awesome. We rock.
We do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.